Episode 30 with Venerable Panyavati.
Where meditation meets daily life, this is the Meditation Freedom Podcast.
Thank you so much for joining the Meditation Freedom Podcast. My name is Sika Rote, and today I'm going to be interviewing Venerable Panyavati, who is a former Christian African-American pastor who co-founded and is a co-abbot of the Embracing Simplicity Hermitage in Hendersonville, North Carolina. She was ordained in the Theravada and Mahayana Buddhist traditions and also got transmission from a Zen teacher, Bernie Glassman, of the Zen Peacemakers. And we're going to talk a little bit about her contemplative practice as well as her contemplative practice into compassionate action. And she is an international teacher and advocates on behalf of disempowered women and youth globally. Panyavati was a 2008 recipient of the Outstanding Buddhist Women's Award. And then in 2009, she received a special commendation from the Princess of Thailand for humanitarian acts, where she ordained Thai bhikkhunis on Thai soil with Thai monks as witnesses. Countries like Thailand and Cambodia, where she's also helping ordain Cambodian samaneris in Cambodian temples that until recently did not have female ordination. And Panyavati continues to visit Thailand every year, helping to ordain and train and offer support for these nuns and assisting in their projects. She's also founding circle director of the Sisters of Compassionate Wisdom, which is a 21st century translineage Buddhist order and sisterhood that was formed in 2006. And then another thing she's been doing is back in 2011, she adopted 10 untouchable villages in India, where she vows to help establish egalitarian communities, and at the same time providing wells, books, teachers, and microloans. And then closer to home, in Henderson, North Carolina, Panyavati founded My Place Incorporated, which houses homeless youth between the ages of 17 and 23 over the past 4 years. And this effort included a separate 501 nonprofit, which now has its own academic platform and job training program, residential program, and a social enterprise called My Gluten-Free Bread Company. So with that, let's get right into the interview with Venerable Panyavati. Well, thank you so much, Venerable Panyavati, for joining me in this podcast. Really appreciate you taking your time out.
Thank you, Siko, for inviting me.
What I've been doing with this meditation podcast is, and I like that as the kind of the icebreaker, is to find out from the person that I'm interviewing how they got to a practice, what got their interest piqued into a meditation practice. And we talk with people from all kinds of lineages and traditions. And so maybe you can talk a little bit about what brought you to kind of where you are today in terms of your interest in meditation.
Okay, so I'm asked this question a lot, particularly because I was a Christian pastor. And of course, you know, we pray, so we don't do much in the way of meditation. Of course, they're starting to now because a lot of people are finding some benefit in meditation.
Right.
So we're finding ways to bring in some contemplative time into the Christian diaspora. But for me, I didn't know anything about meditation. I was praying. I was getting some results, sometimes good, sometimes not good. But one thing I was noticing is that I had no problems with God or Jesus, but I often had a problem with you. And I saw that something else was needed because something in the mind was not fruitful. The heart, no problem. Mm-hmm. But there was a disconnect between the heart and the mind. And so I was looking for a way to bring myself into correspondence so that what I want to do, I do. What I don't want to do, I don't do. What I want to say, I say. What I don't want to say, I say. And how I want to be, I can be that way. And things that I want to abandon, ways, modes of being, I could easily abandon. And so my story is a long one, so somebody can look it on the internet and they can find the long story. The short version is that I began to just pray and ask for guidance on what I needed to do, and I felt I got an answer, a response, and it was that I needed to look outside of Christianity and what I had already learned, that there was a way that I could come into this place that I was seeking. And so in time, it took a long time, 15 years before I discovered the Dharma. And when I did, it was like someone had given me a book. And as I read the book, I felt like I could literally eat the pages off the book. They so satisfied me. So first, I got a bit of good news. The good news is that I wasn't helpless. I wasn't impotent. And that I was not going to be able to achieve it unless I relied on myself. I was not going to be able to come into the fullness of who I am simply by relying on the completed work of someone else. There was some work I was going to do for myself. And but if I did this work, then I could actually transform. And what I want to do, I can do. And what I don't want to do, I wouldn't have to do. And so that's how it started for me. Learning meditation was easy for me because I was used to times of sitting, you know, in silence. But I sat in silence waiting on the Lord, waiting on an answer. Now I learned to sit in silence and become aware of pure presence. And with presence comes a certain wisdom that goes beyond the wisdom or understanding I get by through my sense gates, what I see or hear, taste or touch or smell or think. The Buddha includes thinking. And so I learned to that I could enter into a space where everything becomes clear for me. Mm-hmm. And in this space of clarity, there is a strength of heart, and there is a settledness that allows me to not have to engage myself and my thoughts about things. I can just simply see. And in that seeing, I am informed, and I come away with a different idea of what is happening right here, right now, and what is my role in it, what's required. So this is hard to talk about for a person who doesn't meditate. This is like the Buddha said, you can't read about this and understand it. It's something that you have to do. But in the doing of it, it becomes clear and it becomes apparent. So there's this settling down that occurs. Mm-hmm. You actually come to a stilling of thought. And in that stillness, there is a certain vastness of consciousness. There's a certain expansion of insight and understanding and awareness. And as you immerse yourself in this, when you come out, you come out with a different view. You know, so many times the scientists will say, we were trying to come up with a solution to this problem. We just couldn't do it. And they go and they lay down.
Right.
And they snap and they wake up. Eureka, I've got it. You know, so it's something like that. We have all of this information that we take in from the outside. You know, I call that tuition. But we're so wonderfully made that there is an intuition, something that rises up from the inside. We're perfectly equipped. But there's a place we have to go to tap into, to access that faculty, that capacity that we have to be better, to be present.
Right. And I think you mentioned earlier waiting versus just kind of sitting and becoming aware and being open-handed. There's a huge difference in the sense, because waiting seems to be more future oriented, where just relaxing into what is right now is more present oriented.
Well, waiting, it's kind of a double-edged sword. You know, I think of waiting in the old sense as if I was waiting on someone or to do something for me, mm-hmm. to empower me, to give me something, to give me an answer, to, you know. But this waiting, I'm speaking of Now with meditation, it's more like when you go to a five-star restaurant and there's the waiter standing very close by your table, not too close, not too far, you know, and he has the cloth over his arm and he's there being very present, but almost invisible. He's just waiting to see the slight movement of the head that says, I need something. You know, he's watching the glass to see when he should immediately move, step forward to fill it. So there's something very pregnant in that presence. It's right. Like being right there. It's seeing deeply. So I try not to use the word relax, because we have this notion that meditation is like just all just relaxing and letting go.
Right. Yeah, but that can be taken the wrong way. Yeah.
Yeah, it can. It's a very active type of engagement in investigating the structure of appearances.
Right. And you mentioned a waiter, and now that got me to think about attending, which is a word that I like a lot, being attentive to the present and paying attention to each moment and what's going on in our minds and our hearts and everything, and honoring whatever is here. What do you think of the word attention?
I do like that word, attending, and it is very much like that. You know, being a mother, I know what that means. I know how to attend. and you can get so good at it that, you know, a mother can be in another room. And if the baby is fidgeting, the mother knows the connection goes beyond a very gross, dense level. You know, I mean, we exist, if you want to speak of existence, on a lot of different levels, one of them being like an energetic level. So where do I really end? Do I end right here at my skin? You know, once you become entombed in this way, you can literally wrap another person, you know, so not so much conversation is needed. You can know how another person is thinking. You can know how another person is feeling, because we don't just end at the skin.
Mm-hmm. Right. But we're so trained to think that we end with the boundary of our skin bag.
Yes, yes, we are. And if we stop right there, then of course there's the automatic setup for me, my, and mine, and then everybody else.
Right.
But if we can tap into experientially this interconnectedness that we have, it will change the focus of our thoughts. It will change the way we think about things and the way we think about others. And we'll start to be able to consider others as oneself. But it's only because we have a very rigid dividing line between ourselves and others that we have so many of the problems that we have today. If we even consider others as oneself, like I want to be happy. I don't want to be separated from my happiness. So I must think that others feel that same way. And when I put myself in their place, or put them in my place, superimpose them, then I come away with a different idea of what's required in the way I engage and interact with them.
Right, right. And how has this this progression been from you moving towards a meditation practice, from prayer to meditation, and then I guess you went from Theravadan to Mahayana, or you did both at the same time, or that's kind of an interesting part too.
Yeah, well, I actually started Mahayana, and of course that was easy because, you know, there is a lot of devotion in Mahayana, which I absolutely love, because I think it's a way that it really opens the heart. It allows us to be vulnerable, you know, or we think of it as being vulnerable, but in it we find our true strength. We find out who we really are as human beings. And that was very good. But then on down the road, I ran into a Theravadan monk, and he gave me a copy of the Majjhima Nikaya. And like when I read it, it was like so clear. You know, as I said in the beginning, I didn't have a heart problem. It was that I had a problem with my my mind, my understanding was not fruitful. And so that meant that I could love you today, but if you stepped on my foot too hard, then, you know, we were gonna have a problem. You know, it was the mind couldn't always live in the field of the heart. Mm-hmm. And so I needed something to renew the mind, to tune the mind, to train the mind. And I found that in the Buddha's teachings. You know, this wonderful mind training. That's what I love about it. And so now I'm learning to be an island unto myself, not looking for anything from anyone else. I am learning to look inside, and while I may not be able to control everything that happens in the exterior world, I can certainly control my response to it. And mm-hmm. therein lies the freedom, you know. Therein lies the liberation from the mental suffering, how I see and respond, you know, to the present moment.
Right. And I mean,
talk is cheap too, you know.
Right. Yeah.
We can learn the jargon. We can talk it all day long. But in the moment when I really need it to rescue me, you know, is it there? Is it there for me? And that's where practice comes in.
Right.
You know, so we practice, but, you know, I always tell people practice doesn't make perfect. Perfect practice makes perfect. Mm-hmm. And we have to, we don't know that we have it until the moment arises that we have to, you know, that we have to live it, we have to use it. But then we can know. We can know that, Paniwad, you have more work to do in that area. You know, and then no harm, no foul, you see. No guilt associated with that, just clear seeing. Clear seeing, I have more work to do in that area. And so that eliminates that whole area around falling short, missing the mark, sin, guilt, shame. All of that, it has no place. It's just being able to see clearly and to understand the causes and conditions, what produces this present moment, and whether I was skillful or unskillful, you know, and whether I did it volitionally with full knowing I was going to do it, but this is just how I'm feeling about you right now, or whether I was able to apply restraint and live in my integrity of how I think I should respond versus my habitual tendency, you know. And so it's so interesting and it's a wonderful practice, and it is so full, you don't have time to focus on anybody else, you know. It takes all your time mm-hmm. to look at yourself.
Right, right. How has the practice, your practice, evolved over time to let go of some of those old ingrained patterns that we have? And it's very liberating, as you said earlier, to let that go. Has that completely just kind of worked through, or do you still find old, you know, some of that, those really old habit patterns that can still sometimes peek through a little bit?
Oh yeah, every day. Every day I find some kind of old habit pattern that's coming up, you know. And this is the work, to just keep looking. You know, I mean, I got in the beginning, maybe I didn't expect to see that many. I didn't know what was wrong, but whatever was wrong, I think it was wrong out there, you know.
Right.
Now I have accepted that there is maybe some wrong view in here. And if I adjust how I see something, then I can also adjust how I respond to it. Here's the thing, that even, you know, when we become okay, if you want to say it that way, with ourselves, that's still just us. But this practice helps you to be, to also not blame others.
Right.
To also not shame others, to, you know, so your whole life starts to shift and take on a kind of, you move into an ease dimension where you can go for days and weeks without having any sense of crossness, you know, not upset with anybody.
You're not taking things personal.
Personally, right. You're not taking things personally. You're not feeling depressed. You're not, you know, in sorrow. You're not in anger. It's just seeing what today brings and handling it to the best of your ability. And then you could just reflect, you know, I could improve on that. And endeavor to improve, not just say I could, but really endeavor to, you know, improve. The capacity for improvement increases in direct proportion to the eradication of guilt and shame. I can say that, yes.
Right, right, because there's a certain acceptance that takes place, which then frees up resources, I think, in us,
yeah.
As opposed to this barraging self-criticism that we're so used to, especially in the West, I guess.
And I think that that's harder because we're such an individual-oriented society.
Right.
Everything is about achievement, being the best, you know, being the greatest, having the most. And, you know, all of these messages that we get from everywhere, you know, kind of propel us towards that sort of neurosis, where in many other countries or many other societies, there is a, you know, a more... a communal way
of
life, you know, like we're all in this together. That's something that we're really just coming to terms with now. I mean, but we're a young society, you know, we're a little over 200 years old. We're still adolescents. I don't know if we're even that old in terms of, you know, civilizations. But we're, you know, we're having to learn this kind of coming together. That's what all this diversity conversation is about, you know. Well, they talk about diversity. I like to talk about unity, unification of mind. And I think that a lot can be accomplished if the more we see our commonalities, you know, and engage one another, being able to hold someone else's view the same way that we hold ours. I mean, like, I respect mine. You know, mm-hmm. can I respect yours as your view, you know, for you? And if I think it's a unbeneficial view, then have I developed any skillfulness to try to lay out an alternative way of looking and thinking about something? You know, but if I come at you fighting, there's a good chance we're not going to have that conversation.
Right. It just escalates. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know who said that, but the words inner disarmament, because when you disarm on the inside, then automatically you disarm on the outside. It seems like it just works hand in hand.
Yeah.
You've talking about meditation and how it affected your life and changed you, but then at some point something shifted in you and you started taking that out in the world as well in terms of bringing your whatever you realized into the world, and you're accomplishing all kinds of stuff. And maybe we can talk a little bit about how you're ordaining people in countries that don't, that had a very male-oriented culture that then seeped into their religion as well. And so they didn't allow women to be ordained, like in Thailand, Cambodia. There's a whole bunch of countries. How did that start with you, or what got you going on that?
Well, I, you know, sometimes people say, well, when did you leave Christianity and become this? For me, you know, whatever labels other people want to use, an ism, ist, or whatever, I hold all that very loosely. For me, I just kept going on the path, you know, whatever the path names are, labels you want to give them. Now, if I had been a Catholic, then I would have been a nun and I would have been a missionary, you know. But I wasn't a Catholic. I was a Baptist and we didn't have nuns. And our missionary work was basically fundraising to pay off the church and things like that, you know. So I wanted to really engage more with people and felt a heart for people. And I found a way to do that, being a Pentecostal and a charismatic, because it was really heart-to-heart connection. So when I became a Buddhist 15 years later, I found that didn't seem to have quite as much heartfulness in it. There was a great progress being made with understanding how things are, but you know, that's just one part of this. And how it becomes something that is dynamic, that's alive, and that impacts other people's lives. I didn't see too much movement in that direction. So I just started doing what I did, you know, as a Christian. Well, in the beginning, I would get emails saying, oh, Panwadi, monastics don't do that. Monastics don't do that. Monastics don't do this, you know. And so finally, I just decided, okay, well, people are my forest. So when I go out to the forest, I go out to people. People are my forest. And I just make myself available. You know, I didn't really set out to do anything in particular except for being available. You know, like you send out a beacon and it makes that sound, you know, right. And there's the drawing from that sound. So I maybe just send up the I'm available sound, you know. And I got a call from a nun in Thailand, and she said, would you come and help me? I guess maybe I'd said a few things so she could see I wasn't timid.
Right.
I'm not faint of heart, I that's for sure. And she said, I need someone strong who's not afraid, you know, of the tradition, because we need to make a change here. And I said, okay, I'll come and see what you're doing, and I'll come and help. Now, she's living there, and she's not a Thai, you know, citizen, so she could be deported. But because I fly in and I do the ordinations, she just stays there and works with them after they've been ordained, so she's safe, and I serve a purpose, you know. And it's no more than that, just looking to see how we can employ skillful means to help do something useful and something beneficial. But one thing, being African-American, you know, I have a definite view about some things. And one is, if you see an opportunity for your freedom, don't bother to ask your master, just seize it. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't really subscribe to the notion of asking so much for, you know, the monks to accept women to set in a lineage again. If the council said no, then that's it. I look for another door. I look for another gate. And we were able to use our wonderful sisters in the Mahayana tradition, because both of our lineages come through, you utilize the Dharmagupta, so it's the same Vinaya. And so we were able, originally using the Mahayana nuns, I'm there to represent the Theravada, and we were able to ordain them. Now we have full platforms with all Theravadins, and so it now has been established that we have, as of last year, 35 nuns. I don't really like to call them nuns. I like to call them female monks. You know, they have this way that they diminish the women. For instance, males are called Bhante, you know, like revered teacher, mm-hmm. and the women are called Ani, which means auntie, or Aya, which means sister. So one's a revered teacher, the other's like sister or auntie. You know, like right there, that sets in some idea.
In motion, you
know,
yeah.
In motion, right. Amongst, you know, all of the people of that society in terms of worthiness and in terms of equality. So it's just little ways that, so I always refer to myself as a female monk, not from any prideful, you know, thinking, but just being clear and validating for other women. Otherwise, they'll take on this role, but they still like act like auntie and sister.
Yeah, interesting. Because I didn't know that history, but I would think a monk had like a male feel to it. But I didn't realize that a nun had a lower connotation to it than a monk. Yeah, because it seems like somehow that crept in a long time ago, and people who really understand Buddhism, they see the equality between everything, and that we're just have skin bags around us, and you know, whether that's male or female or one color or another, that shouldn't matter at all. But somehow, because I'm assuming people spend too much time looking at these their senses and the appearances, that somehow that crept in as one thing is better than another, or higher or more elevated or more special than the next skin color or skin something.
Yeah, it is. And that's why, you know, the Buddha cautions us to set a watch. You know, that's the first part of our practice, is to begin to draw our gaze in, you know, to be careful of how we hear. That third precept, it talks about avoiding, we say, sexual misconduct, but it was sensual misconduct. And that means, like, don't take everything you see as the gospel truth. That's, you know, because our seeing can be faulty. Our hearing can be faulty. I remember I was at a retreat last week, and a person came up and they heard the tail end of a conversation, you know. And then later, when I was having my one-on-one with them, they wanted to talk about how I responded to a person. And it appeared to be one way because they only heard the tail end of the conversation. But if they had heard the whole conversation, then they would have come away with a different understanding, you know. And I had two choices. I could explain the whole conversation, or I could just remind them that, you know, you can't take too much stock in what you hear. You know, you have to be careful of the assumptions that we draw from the limited information that we take in through the sense gates. And then we get all out of sorts about it. And when somebody comes and explains, oh, I understand. I'm sorry. You know, but if we get in the habit of not doing that, then we find that we'll have more peaceful, happy minds. We'll be, we won't be busybodies. And we can learn how to even tolerate or even overlook a slight.
Right.
And these are the ways that we really suffer, like when you overlook me. Like, I can remember the time that I would, if you made me feel invisible, you would know that I was here. But now it's not that important to me. You know, if I'm invisible, you know, maybe you don't want to talk to me, and I can leave it at that. You know, and I'm not the least bit offended. Your loss, maybe,
right.
You know. So it's all these kinds of different ways. It's how this practice, and not just meditation, but he says, you know, so we talk about mindfulness and being mindful. Well, you know, we're already mindful. It's just, what are you mindful of? So this not just the criteria of mindfulness. Mindfulness is always attached to something, you know, and if we forget that, then we'll run off on a tangent with mindfulness, but we won't have, you know, the whole picture. We won't be able to bring it together correctly for its highest and its best use. I mean, a sociopath is extremely mindful.
Yeah.
You know, but where is his attention? You know, and what other factors inform that intention? You know, in his development or cultivation of kindness and care for others, or her compassion, you know. So there's this eightfold path, of which mindfulness is one aspect of that.
Right.
But there's these other seven that we have to tend to, starting with right view. So we have to seek out people that we think are wise, unless I think I'm wise and don't need anybody. But if I'm still suffering, then there's probably some wisdom I could tap into to become better. You know, so you seek out one who is wise and hear what they have to say. And then he said, don't just hear it, don't just accept it, you know, but put it into the cauldron of your experience. Investigate and see if that doesn't, if that inures to your happiness or to more benefit. He says, if so, then you should cleave to that. If not, abandon it.
Right.
And keep
Always
keep
verify it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
With your own with your own experience and practice. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, that's one of the reasons I like doing this show, too, is because you know, now you're seeing this trend of mindfulness as being very popular, but it's being used, like you said, for a sociopath maybe to do their skill better, and maybe as there's a lot of things that it's being used for where it's being cut off from the moral and the wisdom part, and it's just as a, you know, here's how you can win the game better, or the Seattle Seahawks were talking about how they can win better if they're mindful, practice mindfulness.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been a little bit, and don't get me wrong, I think that it's wonderful, you know, that this part of the Dharma has moved into the mainstream society, because without it, I don't think you could go much further. Everybody's not going to sign up to be a Buddhist. That's just it.
Right.
You know, simply because of the identification of a label. And but if you take something out of its container, then some of the efficacy is lost and some of the benefit is lost. Yet there has been some exposure. And so I'm happy that mindfulness perhaps has moved into the mainstream, but we still have work to do. So I'm happy to see that there are other teachers, there are teachers, myself included, that are really trying to point to the complementary practices and the deeper teachings of the sages, so that we can be all around better, not just happier with our things,
mm-hmm.
you know, right. something like that. And it's one of the reasons why we're opening up the Balsam Mountain Refuge, to make sure that a more complete teaching is introduced into mainstream society without having to use a Buddhist label, you know, or being able to tap into this universal wisdom that may have come out of another spiritual tradition, you know. Being able to be with one another and really discuss things, instead of coming into an environment where it's all silent and everybody's eyes are down, and you come in and you go out the same way, just with your thoughts or your busy mind, or maybe with an empty mind, but go back into the same environment. You know, this the Buddha said that that good friends in the Dharma is the whole of spiritual life. So there is a role that we play with one another. And many of us, the only time that we have a time to connect is when we come together, you know, at retreat. We live in areas where there's no Dharma center, or, you know, or we don't talk in our Dharma hall. We just come on Tuesday, Thursday, and Sunday for an hour, hear Dharma, meditate, and go out. Mm. You know, so these are places where we can cultivate and develop long-lasting and very dear friendships. We think that the introduction of this kind of different type of meditation center will bring us more back to a middle road place. You know, in the Buddha's day, he would give them an instruction or a teaching, show them a technique, tell them what to focus on in meditation, and then he sent them off. And they would each go somewhere, sit at the root of a tree, whatever, and they would practice alone. Now, in our country, over the centuries, we do it kind of differently. You know, we all come together to sit in silence and not be in communion with each other. We're just all there individually, and then we go out. That's the exact opposite. He brought them together. When they came together, he talked about the 10 kinds of conversations they should have with one another during that precious time together, and then they would go out again into their individual meditation. So it's interesting how things turn around, and sometimes we need to reverse.
Yeah.
To go back to something in a way that was offered, we can find something else to squeeze out of it.
Yeah, it sounds like it is really adapting here as it moved to the West and the United States, this Buddhism.
Yeah.
And so the other thing I wanted to mention to you, you're helping what used to be called Untouchables, and I don't know how to what extent that's still being used, the Dalit, you know, the caste system, which is another thing that's kind of has a similar theme to what we were talking about earlier, where people they take a teaching and then they twist it a little bit around to meet certain needs, and it kind of is corrupted from the initial understanding of equality, because a caste system to me is putting one group on a higher level than another, and that creates all kinds of problems then. But it looks like you've been working on helping level that playing field.
Well, the one thing I have to say is that I needed to educate myself, because I didn't really realize that untouchability was still in existence. You know, they had the anti-atrocity law that came out in 1950, and that was supposed to be the end of untouchability. But, you know, it's not laws that do things to people. It's people who do things to people.
Right.
And people are still very much in that long-held custom of ranking in according to caste. So the Dalits have renamed themselves. They call themselves Dalits, which means broken, the broken people. And we do go there and work. Some people say untouchability doesn't exist. It absolutely does. I didn't even understand what that meant until I went there. And you can just see, like, walking down the street with a person, they have to be careful where their shadow falls, because if their shadow falls on an upper caste person, a Brahmin, he's considered polluted and has to go home and bathe. You know, just the very shadow. So I couldn't understand this degree of inhumanity. You know, and they don't think of it that way. They think of it, well, that's the law of Manu. And, you know, if they're born into this caste, then it must be because of something they did in a previous life. They need to just accept it and burn that karma up, and next life they'll be born something different. Well, Buddha, that whole idea was prevalent in the Buddha's day. And he tried to change that by simply saying, you know, it's not by virtue of your birth that your status as a human is made known. It's by what you do with your life, mm-hmm. you know. And so even in that day, he was working in his own way against the understanding, the erroneous understanding about of one person being more worthy than the other just on basis of birth, you know. And of course, we have a lot of these same views all over the world and in many other countries, including our own country,
right.
you know. So how are you going to change that? I mean, like, laws are helpful to a degree, but, you know, laws are for people. People are not for laws. You know, so the only way that we're going to change how we relate to one another is through the heart, you know.
Doing the inner work.
Yeah. And so it's wonderful to be there with them, and I don't consider myself doing so much for them. I tell you, what I get from them is more than what I give, without a doubt. To see people who have, you know, absolutely no standing, and yet they're so kind and they're so gentle, and it's just a pleasure. You know, it's a pleasure to work with them at what they are initiating, what they are working towards. So I take a team out once or twice a year, and we do what we call bearing witness retreats. You know, so we go there and not showing up. We just show up, not knowing, not thinking, oh, I know what you need. You know, but we come to say that we're in solidarity with you, and tell us what your aspiration is. Tell us what you need. So when I first went, you know, someone had asked me to come over and teach the Dhamma, and I went over there to teach the Dhamma. These people didn't have water. You know, so I said, well, before you can start teaching about Dhamma, we have to figure out how to help them have some water.
Right.
You know, And so we started, you know, the well project. Then, you know, and so it went on like that. We would add something. We would do something when we go back in December. You know, we're starting a health program because, you know, diarrhea from unsanitary conditions is one of the, you know, the most critical ways that we can support just the common person having, you know, having a useful and a long life. And so we have some doctors who are basically work out of Haiti, and they've come up with a great program to train uneducated community people in how to be health workers. They can set broken bones, they give, you know, something for diarrhea and things like that, and also teaching about sanitation. We started installing toilets. You know, we're bringing books and helping them with education. So one thing leads to another, but not from a project standpoint, just from people touching people and seeing a need and responding to it. It's like that.
So it's, in a way, that's like teaching Dharma outside of words. It's it's teaching Dharma in the way you're being and in your actions.
Yeah, it's just living it. I was at a school there, and the principal was very suspicious. The parents had asked for books and things, and she was very suspicious of our being there. I didn't really understand why, but another group had come in, 68, I think it was, and built this school, and they built a church, and they had since abandoned, you know, the colony. But when we came in and we started doing things like, there were 68 children and no toilets, you know? So we built latrines. The roof was leaking. We started making repairs to the building, you know, painting it inside and out and doing different things. And in the beginning, you know, she wanted our help, needed our help, but still there was that, you know, that wall that was up there. And this went on for a couple of years. And then finally last year, she came to see us on our last day there. She came to another village because we'd already left her village. And she said, I just want to say that the last group that was here taught us about God. She said, but I see God now. You know, and what she was saying was it wasn't just talk. And it wasn't just doing something, you know, but there was a heart-to-heart engagement that went beyond any physical thing that we were doing, you know, out here. And it wasn't just talk.
Mm-hmm.
It's just really being one with them. And I think that's what we're longing for. We don't know it, but we try to satisfy that longing with things, you know, from degrees to cars, you know, when there's really something else that the heart is yearning for. And that's that interconnection with all other beings.
And the sense of belonging.
Well, I think in the sense of, you know, not even so much belonging, but knowing who we really are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think I'm less than what I am. You know, then I don't function fully.
Right.
But when I know who I truly am, then I function fully. There's no sense of deficiency in me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then happiness comes with that, a confidence that life has meaning and that I can seize the essence of a human life and that it's a precious human life.
Right. And everything is precious then.
Yeah, yeah, everything. And this world that is a hell realm becomes a Buddha land.
Right. Yeah. Because that's another thing, trap we tend to fall into, is that we want to get out of this world because there might be a better one after, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, the Buddha said it's like whatever seeds you plant, that's the tree that's going to grow. So you don't have to be like striving and praying to get to heaven. You know, it's like just plant heaven seeds,
right,
you know,
here.
you plant heaven seeds. It's like if you plant an apple seeds, you're going to get an apple tree. You're not going to get a peach tree. So you do good deeds, then there's going to be a good destination. For the one who believes in who desires a heavenly rebirth, he said, then plant the seeds that produce that kind of tree. That's all you have to do. Then you don't have to ask anybody, can you get in? You don't have to, you just plant the tree, the seeds, and water. That's all.
Right. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, well, maybe you have one more thing you want to tell listeners and on how to be more at peace with yourself and with the world and more connected. Maybe you have some final tips for somebody listening who's thinking about that.
I think you just said it. Listen. If we will open ourselves up to just listen to others without, crafting our response while they're speaking, without thinking they don't know, I'm the one who knows, without tearing apart how they said it, without manufacturing in our minds why we think they said it. But if we will just start developing the practice of listening and being able to just hold our tongue and our thoughts for a few minutes, then I think our understanding can grow and we can be better at how we respond. And that's part of what meditation does.
Right.
It teaches us to take that pause, have that downtime instead of a knee-jerk reaction. We'll become happier. Our hearts will become healthier. And I think that we'll be friendlier.
I agree. That's great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time again. And I really appreciate all the things you've shared. And thanks so much. And is there anything you would like to share, where people can find more about you or if they would like to follow up and see more of what you've just shared?
Well, you can always go out to my website at pannavati.org, pannavati.org. And starting next week, you can go out to our new website, balsamrefuge.org, balsam refuge.org, and see what we're trying to put together with this new community and come and be a part of it.
Great. Thanks again, and I will keep following and see what else you're doing in the future.
Okay, my friend.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Pannavati, and I certainly did. The show notes for this episode are at meditationfreedom.com/30. Feel free, as always, to leave a few comments if you enjoyed this. And as I'm putting the final edits on this podcast episode, I just wanted to mention as well that if you enjoyed this podcast in any way or if you got some value out of it, please consider going to iTunes or any of the places where this podcast is being posted. Consider giving it a review, maybe just clicking the stars to show your interest in this podcast, or leave a review. That's even more wonderful. Well, I hope you have a wonderful day and rest of your week. I know I did have a wonderful day. Instead of finishing this podcast, I decided that taking care of my health was more important, and I went out and did a climb up to a ridge behind the Santa Rosa Mountains, and it was wonderful. There was some sprinkles, and eventually I ended up being chased down with tail between legs from some thunder and lightning, and I thought I better get the hell off this mountain. So that was my day. I hope you have a wonderful day as well, and give yourself some time as well to pause and enjoy the present moment and just take an occasional break wherever you are. Take care.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Meditation Freedom Podcast, where meditation meets daily life.